Hello. For this episode of Airs for Architecture, I spoke with photographer and filmmaker Jim Stevenson about his work documenting buildings and the current and ongoing exhibition he and artist Sophia Smith have showing at the Farrell Centre in Newcastle, The Architect Has Left the Building.
Airs for Architecture, a podcast about architecture, buildings, urban culture and space.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Airs for Architecture. I'm talking today to Jim Stevenson, the photographer. Jim, can you introduce yourself more fully than that, please?
Thank you, Ambrose. Thanks for inviting us on as well. It's nice to sit down and chat with you. I mean, part of my life is a photographer. I'm also a filmmaker, and I just spend my days traveling around documenting the built environment for architects and designers and magazines and all of those people.
So it sounds so simple, but I appreciate that it isn't really that simple. How did you get to be a photographer? How does one get to be an architect, specifically an architectural photographer? You don't have a side industry in weddings.
No, God, no. I tried. Yeah, it does sound simple because fundamentally my job is basically pressing a button at the right time. And I try not to make it any more complicated than that. But I started off, I don't want to paraphrase a very famous mob film, but as long as I can remember, I always wanted to be an architect. But I wasn't good enough. I wasn't bright enough to do that at university. So I ended up doing architectural technology at university. My dad's an engineer, civil engineer as well. So he kind of instilled me with a healthy dose of cynicism with architects. Which obviously I've shed that since. But so I did architectural technology, you know, with this idea that I could design, but also, you know, build and learn about the physics of buildings. And I worked as an architect I worked as an architectural technologist in architecture practices for many years, about 10 years in the US and the UK. Actually, since I was sort of 17, I was, you know, doing draftsman's work or printing with, you know, horrible iodine printers and things like that. But then in 2009, when everything went terrible with the economy, or one of the times everything went terrible with the economy, I got made redundant and couldn't get another job. Like most of my work was, you know, on site or doing, you know, construction drawings, and nobody was building anything. So there was nothing for me to do in that industry. The only other jobs I'd had was working on building sites. I worked in a shop when I was at university, in a closed shop, but the high street had shut down, building sites had shut down. The only other thing I could do was take pictures. I was as a hobby, and architects were having to work much harder to get work in. So they were still commissioning photographers. So I just jumped on that, and I assumed it would be a break, a temporary thing, to pay the rent, because I didn't have any, you know, savings or anything. And then now that was like 15 years ago, and I don't think it's a temporary thing anymore.
I don't think it is, no. I mean, you've got a sort of stellar reputation now within the architectural world. It's must be quite a strange moment.
It is. Thank you, by the way. Yeah, it is a strange thing. I mean, the strangest thing is, you know, you meet these people that you've studied. Like I studied, you know, you know, so I was at university sort of like 2000, 2001. So Sarah Wigglesworth's house and studio had just been finished. And that was like it became a running joke that I was using that as a president study in every single project I did at university, particularly my final year for my big design project, basically ripped it off. I did my whole dissertation on building with straw bales, which of course, you know, Sarah used in the house. And then you meet them, and then I went to their house and hung out with them and had a cup of teas and stuff, and realized that all these people that I'd studied and you know, held up in my late teens, early 20s, you know, same with, you know, Richard Rogers or, you know, any number of people that I've ended up working with, you meet them and realize actually they're just like really sound normal people. For the most part, they're really sound normal people. So yeah, it's a funny thing, sort of getting used to working with, you know, with some of the people that I still hold in such high regard.
And you have an exhibition on at the Farrell Centre in Newcastle at the moment, which has been at the RIBA as well. The architect has left the building. Which has been, again, extremely well received. Perhaps you'd like to talk about where that, tell me where that came from. Like, what was the inspiration? Was that a, was that something that you were approached to do, or was that a kind of creative outlet that you then pitched? And what's the show about, I suppose?
Well, it all came about, it's quite interesting, actually. I'd been making a series of films for the Architects Journal about the Stirling Prize shortlist, and I was filming the Hackney New Primary School that Henley Hale Brown did, that was shortlisted a couple of years ago.
So and you were doing that, this was a couple of years ago that you were doing that work?
Yeah, so that was it last year, 2000, was it 2022?
Yeah, maybe. Maybe the year before.
Yeah, so like last year or the year before, I forget, like, I don't mean to imply that the Stirling Prize has started to roll into one blur, but I forget what year it was. But yeah, anyway, I was doing that, brilliant building. I was working with my assistant, Hannah, and we were having an amazing time documenting it. And there's a bench outside the school that we'd interviewed Simon Henley earlier that day, and he was talking about the benches, you know, and we sort of stood there, Hannah and I, filming it for ages, you know, for an hour, just with one shot pointing straight at this bench while we waited for parents to come and pick up their children from the school. And we sort of realized that this is a whole sort of brilliant soap opera. Well, there's no drama, but it was kind of this beautiful moment of human activity unfolding in front of us. So we filmed it for ages. I tweeted a picture of it, or X, or whatever we're calling Twitter these days. I tweeted a picture of it and just said, I've had a really great day filming. The whole film could have just been this one shot for 5 minutes. A locked off shot of the bench. And Pete Collard, who's does the exhibitions at Reba, got in touch about 3 or 4 months after that tweet and basically just said, do you want to do this? Do you want to make this into a thing? We want you to be our, you know, the summer exhibition at us at Reba HQ. Can you expand upon this? And so I worked with my partner, Sophia, who's also a photographic artist. And we ended up sort of blowing this thing up and expanding it and expanded it. And the final thing features 14 different buildings from across the UK and is a sort of half an hour looping installation. Be two massive screens with 7 speakers surrounding you, by all done by Simon James, this brilliant sound artist. Completely, I think immersive is a slightly overused word, but it is kind of completely immersive. You can't see anything else and you can't hear anything else. So it is immersive. And it's an exercise in people watching. The intention is that you can just sit there. Architecture becomes the stage set. It recedes into the background, and you can just sit there and watch everything unfold in front of you. And it's been lovely actually seeing the reception to it.
That moment you had at Hackney Primary School, was that within your mode of practice as a film and photography documenter of building anyway? Was that is this the kind of photography that you have approached? And perhaps it would be interesting to talk about that a little bit, insofar as, I generally speaking, most media of buildings has historically and still really normatively has avoided those kinds of things. People mainly, because they move around quite a bit, and also because they're scruffy.
Yeah. I like the scruffiness. It absolutely was fitted exactly in our mode of working, and kind of, I suppose it's developed more in the last few years because my work's become, you know, slightly better well known. So I have a bit more freedom. People commission me because they want what I do rather than just commissioning me, you know, as a camera technician. So in the last few years, that part of my work has developed a lot, but really actually fundamentally, that's what my interest in photography isn't in cameras, or isn't in, you know, the art of capturing one great image. It's in people using space, and it just is the camera's just my tool to explore that. If it wasn't if I wasn't using a camera, I'd probably still be working in an architecture practice designing for people, so I might as well be documenting them using the space. And that's where all of my work, well, at its best, that's what my work does, is shows how people use space and sometimes misuse space, and sometimes that way is incredibly active and sometimes that way is incredibly passive. But yeah, that it was very much in the mode of how we would ordinarily work.
And there's a kind of there's a history to that type of, I freely admit I know very, very little about photography. I am not a great photographer. I don't even have a camera. That's actually true. I have a phone. So what kind of this how would you describe this mode of, what genre of film does this fit into, this image making fit into? Is there a kind of heritage? Is it a slice of life? I don't know.
I mean, it's documentary photography, really, is the basis of it. I mean, and when I use the word photography, really, I'm interchanging that between photography, still image and moving image. And I'm just using the word photography because it's a mouthful to keep saying both each time. But yeah, I mean, my work is in photography. I was in documentary style, I suppose. Mm-hmm. You can't really call it true documentary because 95% of my work is commissioned by somebody. So, you know, that removes an element of impartiality that means it's not true documentary, but it definitely takes its callings from documentary photographers and some kind of street photography, but less so. And that's really my interest. I mean, I used to run an organization called MiniClick for 10 years, where every month we put on a free photography lecture, and we used to get people from all over Europe come and do talks for us in Brighton. And we had some amazing people. And that was really my photography education, because, you know, I never studied it or anything. So, we were very heavy on featuring documentary photographers. So that's my interest.
And what's other side? I mean, is there another type of, you know, there's documentary photography and there's other types. I mean,
yeah.
What are the other types, like heroic photography or kind of portrait photography, building portrait photography?
I mean, there's that kind of beautiful sort of more art photography. You know, when we talk about like Alain Benet's work or somebody like that, or, you know, even sort of going back, you know, Balthasar Kolrat. No, I've got that name wrong, sorry. Ezra Stoller. Somebody's going to send me a message. Balthasar Kolrat, is it? But yeah, these kind of images that, let's say Alain Benet, because she's a contemporary, you know, her work is absolutely beautiful textures. It's all about, you know, that a lot of her work's black and white, so it's all about tones and light. Mm-hmm. And completely, really the opposite of mine, because she very rarely features people in her images. And that's another way of documenting architecture. Mm-hmm. And then there's I'm a commercial architectural photographer because I get paid for it. But then you get a more sort of commercial style within the sort of overall genre of documenting buildings that's more kind of real estate-y, you know, which, you know, is kind of a different style in itself. But I think most of the photographers that I'm into operate outside of architecture. They're social documentarians, and that's what I'm interested in.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting to think about both those sides of things. This idea of the architect as the architectural photographer, the architectural, and I'm also using photographer in the broad sense of filmmaking. You know, people who commit things to film, I suppose. Image makers, really interested in that creative act that they are participants in the production of buildings to a certain extent, insofar as, for me, for example, I've never been to the Sagrada Familia. I've never been to Barcelona Pavilion. I, you know, most of my engagement with architecture is actually through the image that photographers take. So photographers have become, and that's true of most people, for most buildings. I think probably the truest example of that is, of course, the Bilbao Center, the Guggenheim in Bilbao by Frank Gehry, where most of us haven't gone. And yet it's become absolutely the most significant building of the last 30 years in terms of changing the perception of architecture. I will probably get comments back from people about that.
Yeah, you will. You will.
I mean, it's obvious it is. I mean, I'm not talking about in terms of its style. I'm talking about in terms of architecture as an instrument of urban regeneration. I think it's undeniable.
Yeah, so. Yeah.
But a lot of that, even that logic of urban regeneration, comes back to the images that have been pictured of it. So I was just wondering about, like, how do you go about working with a building to kind of work out what it's about, and then like what is your process? What does it entail?
I think about this a lot, and I'd really like to give you like a really clear definition of my process. And sometimes students ask me, about my process, and what they really want is something that they can copy and mold to be their own thing. And mm-hmm. But I don't have an answer that's really clear. I mean, so much of my work is instinctive, mm-hmm. Sorry, it's really instinctive when I'm on site, when I'm at a location. And I suppose those instincts are born out of having, worked in the architecture industry for a while, having designed buildings and been in, I know what goes into the design of them. So a degree of it comes from that. And then the other half of it comes from, in fact, I know how to use a camera, and know what, usually I know what composition is going to work all right. But a lot of it, I'm just sort of trusting my instincts, and also trying really hard to remove ego from it, which I have to, if I'm completely honest, I have to check myself on, like most people do, I think. Most particularly men have to a little bit check our egos a little bit, because photography, like architecture, does lend itself and does have a history of exalting this idea of a lone genius, the lone creator that, ventures out and solves something with this art that they are in charge of, architecture or photography, and which I think is, am I allowed to swear?
Yeah,
which I think is bullshit. Obviously, it's ridiculous, because nothing's a lone pursuit anyway. But anyway, that's a completely different subject matter. So I just try and check myself a little bit and remember that all I'm really trying to do is interpret what the architect has told me about the building, because mm-hmm. I'm working for them, add a bit of my own instincts to it, my instincts about what works well, and not just what works well, in a two-dimensional photograph, but also what has physically worked well in the building, what mm-hmm. elements of the building have been successful, and therefore try and show them. And then responding to people is the biggest thing. And really, ultimately, I just want my images to be a trailer, because obviously we don't need to say this, but we know that architecture should be experienced in person. It's better experienced in person than it is in an image. So my images, really, I'm always trying to think, right, these 15 images, if they're in a magazine spread, are they going to encourage someone to go and visit the building and learn more about it? And that's kind of the ultimate aim. My aim isn't, I can try and steer people a little bit, and I can influence them, and I can try and make them hopefully feel a bit like what it's like to be there with film or with photographs. But ultimately, I want them to go and see it and check it out.
With this exhibition, The Architect Has Left the Building, you said, you've worked with your partner, Sophia Smith. And how does that collaborative process work? How do two creative people who... Because there's one thing about, photography is fundamentally an individual thing, because you don't both look through the viewfinder at the same time, kind of. Yeah. So there, I mean, less so these days, because you've got a digital readout. But anyway, you know what I mean? It's like there.
Yeah.
So how does this work? And do you feel that this is very effective on the way that you, the images that you document, and the way that you kind of interpret and engage with the buildings?
Yeah. Well, I suppose in the first instance, of course, like when you're at the viewfinder, it's you at the viewfinder. Mm-hmm. So it's you deciding, when to press the button or when to press record. But actually, fundamentally, that's if you added up the time that I spend at the viewfinder on a day's shooting, it's probably 2% of the day. Most of the day is spent talking about things, watching and observing. So if I'm with somebody else on the site and we're observing stuff, we're talking about what we're seeing, and then I decide to press the button. So really, at the end of it, it's just me, like I said earlier, it's just me pressing the button at the right time. So photography can absolutely be a collaborative process, and film even more so, because, you know, you've got, there's films, a much more involved process. You have sound and you have sequence that adds completely different levels, you know. So when Pete originally got in touch and asked us to do, or asked, came in touch with me and asked me to do the exhibition, my first instinct immediately was to talk with Sophia about it, partly because we've been married for a few years and we talk about our work, but also partly because her background is as a photographic artist. She works a lot with found imagery and archive imagery and resequences them, or creates connections between images that don't really haven't previously had a connection made between them. So she'll bring images from different archives together and lead the viewer to make connections. So particularly with her work, she did a project called Women Looking Out of Windows, which is incredible, an ongoing work that's amazing, but it just made sense. I think even if we weren't, you know, partners and we didn't live together, I would have been looking for somebody, for her or somebody like her to mm-hmm. be involved, because I don't think Sophia was actually on any of the shoots that are part of the Architects That Left the Building. I think it was me with an assistant on each one. So it was really important to have somebody who was a bit removed from the day's filming, because I can't untangle my own emotions from visiting the site or talking to the architect from the footage that I shot. So to have somebody who was a step back from that was really useful. So we printed out a single frame from every single clip, really small, sort of on postcards, printed them out, and she covered the whole floor. Actually, every flat surface in our home got covered with these postcards, because there were hundreds of them. And she just spent, you know, weeks just going around and linking them up visually and by material or by activity or something like that, form or some kind of graphic composition. And she was just linking them up and creating this paper trail that ended up becoming the sequencing in the film. So the sequencing in the film, it was really down to her. And then the third person in all of this was Simon, the sound artist, and his work in creating these like multi-layered, like dozens of layers of sounds that you can hear when you're in the space was completely fundamental to the project. So it very much was a group effort.
And this was sound recorded in the environments of the buildings themselves, or?
Oh, yeah. Well, some of it was, like, some of it was the sound that I'd recorded in the space, but actually in a lot of cases it wasn't. And we said that to Simon specifically, that we weren't really interested in, because this film is an installation, really. It's really not supposed to be a true documentary. And we weren't interested really in telling, you know, some kind of like high truth about these buildings. Mm-hmm. So we said to him, just be creative with the sound. So in some instances, you can hear the sound that was happening in the space. But in some instances, it's completely made up sound. Sometimes it's a sort of musical tone or kind of a musical texture. One instance, because the sound that I'd recorded on site wasn't good enough quality, Simon constructed a tent in his living room, and he hooked up microphones to this tent, and he pulled the canvas over the top of the microphones. And if you've seen the film, you'll know the part that relates to. So he was, you know, in every sense, this kind of mad professor creating these sounds that went along with the footage. And sometimes it's real and sometimes it's not. And that's the joy of it.
Yeah, for sure. Obviously the work, the installation, Architect Has Left the Building, has been reviewed a lot of places, and you sent me some links to some of that, which I'm grateful for. Tom Ravenscroft in D-Zine I thought was really interesting, and he made this point about how your work makes people think about the connections between buildings and how people are connected to them, which I think is that a fair assessment of what you were trying to do? And yeah. and sort of like that's as I said in my notes to you, that's sort of heavy lifting, isn't it? That's like a lot to ask, or it's a lot of pressure to put on you as a kind of visual artist and photographer to do that. Like, that's complicated work.
Yeah, it is. I mean, at my most ambitious, well, that's what I would hope my work does, is make people think about humans and our connection to buildings. I mean, I'd love that. So I hope at its best it can do that. Probably doesn't do that all the time, but it's a lofty ambition, isn't it? Like, but that's kind of, you've got to weigh up something.
Sorry. And so this is the sort of the reason that you use this use of the everyday, this depiction of people within it, so that the buildings themselves don't become unmoored from reality, so to speak.
Yeah.
And sort of end up being kind of buildings as objects. There's an ontological question, isn't there, really? Fundamentally, it's moving away from an idea of what I think Harriet Harris described to me as an object-oriented ontology of architecture, you know, buildings as a kind of discrete entity with walls that you plump down and that's the building, versus this idea of buildings or architecture emerging almost once per your title, the title of your exhibition, once the architect has left.
Yeah, I mean, that's when the building's life starts, isn't it? You know, when the architect has left and disappears and says goodbye to their baby or whatever you want to describe it, you know. Yeah, I mean, Frances Hodgson, really great photographer, writer. I remember having a conversation with him online about this, and he talked about a lot of architectural photography just being evidence that a building was there. And which is kind of true when I do think in a lot of work, not all work, but in a lot of work that treats architecture as a kind of edifice or a sculptural object that you know, has emerged from somewhere and suddenly exists. If you treat it like an edifice, then you're sort of missing the point, really. Like, what's the point in architecture if people don't feel like they're allowed to use it? It's not even if you can't even say what's the point if architecture doesn't work, because, you know, it's ultimately the end user that decides what job that building has to do. It can be a school, but really the end user decides what rooms do what and what spaces does what. They put, you know, the writer writes the book, but the reader, you know, makes the meaning, interprets the meaning. Oh yeah, I got lost there. But yeah, it's basically just, well, I don't know, we talk about this all the time, Safar and I, and other architect friends as well. We talk about, you know, the building just has to make people feel like they're allowed to be in it. And that's why we talk about in our work about showing people using and misusing buildings, because the misuse is obviously interpreted by the architect. But that idea that people feel comfortable, they feel like they're allowed to be there, and they can personalize it somehow, is what really interests us, not the sort of sculptural aspects of a building or you know. I've got to be careful here, because I've got to keep clients. I can't do this podcast and lose half of my work, my clients. But do you know what I mean? Like, I'm not interested necessarily. Like, at its best, we show architecture as this fantastic, brilliant, you know, solid mass of something. Like, it can have amazing form, you know, textures, light moving through it. But actually, at its best, we show that, plus we show.
I was going to say that you can do both things, can't you? And I think that's what I've seen of your work certainly does do. It's sort of looking at the way that architecture supports human activity. And I really like this idea that there's a it was Peter Blundell Jones, my old tutor at Sheffield, my master's dissertation tutor, and just a generally wonderful scholar and teacher. He talked about this, and he was the first person that introduced me to the idea of the sort of problem of architectural photography being this. So moving away from Hélène Binet's kind of approach, which is extremely artistic and sort of undeniably so, and you wouldn't look at her work and say, why the hell isn't there any people in here?
No, absolutely not.
Whereas what was happening at the time, so this was in the early 2000s, I'm probably the same vintage as you, Jim. The photographs weren't artistic, but they also didn't have any people in them. They were just kind of like, wait till everybody's got out the hell out of the way. And the scruffiness of the messiness of human life had been extracted, not for any particular good reason, possibly because the light was bad. They'd put it on a slightly longer exposure to make sure that they, you know, whatever it was, and then humans would be fuzzy. Moving people would be fuzzy. I don't know what the reason was. I really liked this this thing that you see in yours, which is managing to like do both things at the same time, representing the design value or the design intention of the architects, and also the secondary intention of the user, and then the tertiary intention, which is the view and the Sophia of being, you have this remarkably privileged position of being able to fix this building in time. Yours is the legacy.
Yeah, this is when I talk about checking our egos a little bit. Like, I can't think of my work as legacy too much. Otherwise, I'd run amok. but it is true though. Like I am conscious that my images, as with all photography, has two lives. What the first life is that my work is news. It's when architects put those images out there into the press or into social media, and they say, look, we just finished this building and we want to celebrate it, and here's some photographs so you can learn a bit about it. The other life that my photographs live comes 20, 30, 40 years later, mm-hmm. when they're a historical document, and it's like going through an archive then. So there is a sort of degree of that. I mean, I do love looking at, well, everyone loves looking at old photographs of old buildings, you know, or streets that have changed. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a sort of endless fascination with that, even if it's only 20 years ago. So I am sort of quite conscious of that. I think a lot of that sort of style of photographing architecture that was so prevailing for such a long time, particularly, you know, like you were just saying, sort of in the 90s and 2000s, where there weren't any people. I mean, there was a lot of photographers that really liked doing that because, you know, our profession, architectural photography, is quite a technical profession, and it's very satisfying when you get all the technical aspects of it perfect. And it's a lot easier, it's a lot sort of purer to get all that that technique right without people. But a lot of it was architects led as well, and I still get it today when architects say to me, we want you to go in and take the pictures before the people mess it up. Mm-hmm. And which is always a bit of it's just always a bit disappointing, to be honest. Like the idea that people might mess up the building that was designed for them, you know. I sometimes understand it. Like, you know, part of my job, if I'm photographing a home, for instance, is moving furniture around, and sometimes there'll be furniture that we know we don't particularly want to be in the shot. Mm-hmm. But if it's a public building, how much messing up can people do, really? Like, it was meant for them in the first place. And I know it's frustrating when they stick up, you know, laminated A4 signs everywhere in a community center, but that's a community center. That's what happens. Like, I remember photographing the brilliant LSE student center that O'Donnell Toomey did a while back, the brick sculptural, beautiful brick building. And we're going to photograph that. And it was around the time of the student elections were happening. And every internal surface in this concrete and brick monolith was covered in in these neon, gaudy, vote for me for, you know, social chair or posters, like everywhere. And it had clearly become a game with students to see who could get one the highest. So they were like, people must have been climbing up walls to pin these up there. And it was a like total mess, like, but brilliant. And really, yeah. Quite genuinely, I mean, you can't ever pinpoint this kind of thing, but that is one of the projects that I remember visiting, photographing, and just thinking, I love this. Like, this mess is actually like perfect. And the fact that those students felt they could do that, they felt that they were allowed to do that in that building, speaks to the success of that building. Yeah. Just as much as the form of it and the materials and the choreography of moving around it does.
You find that the architects that you work with are happy in this, because there seems something anonymizing in that approach, this idea of taking a building like that, the old O'Donnell Toomey building, and then the thing that's going to jump out at you as the viewer is the life that exists within it, which certainly decenters the architect, in a way decenters the building from public interpretation or engagement with it through the image. Do you think the architects like that? Is that something that, I mean, obviously that's probably why they come to you, isn't it?
Yeah, I, Well, that particular building I did for the Architects Journal, so I had a bit of editorial freedom on that. Although I do think the architects probably wouldn't have minded that too much. Having met them and chatted with them, I don't think they would have been too concerned by it. I think at this point, I think I'm quite fortunate at this point in my career. Most architects come to me because they know, because they want that. And if they don't know when they come to me, you know, after we've had a conversation on the phone, or Zoom or Teams or whatever, at some point it normally comes up that, you know, are people going to be there? Can we get, you know, can we go on a day when it's going to be busy? Or if it's a private house, you know, can the homeowners be in the photographs? Can we have the family around when I'm documenting? So I think at this point, yeah, most of them don't mind. You have to sort of rein it in a bit as well. Like, I can't just, you know, photograph complete mess. It is a kind of controlled mess, what I'm documenting. But I do remember, like, I remember doing a school for Field and Clegg Bradley a couple of years ago, and it was a dining room in this comp in Docklands. And it was, you know, 100 kids under 10 in a dining hall. There's only so much control you can have over the mess that they're going to create. So I did the pictures of the big, beautiful dining hall and the light coming in, and it looked fantastic, and all the students around eating. But I also photographed, like, the total detritus that they'd left behind when they ran out of the room into the playground, and the, you know, the sausages, you know, half eaten sausages or chips that had been squashed into a bench or something. And I did a few pictures of them, and Holly from Field and Clegg emailed me afterwards and just said how much she liked those. And I don't suppose they're particularly useful for awards, but if you're telling the story of a building, that's part of it. You know, everyone has, everyone remembers that as well from, you know, from school. So I think I'm allowed to get away with it a little bit in a controlled way.
I think it's really interesting to think of you as another actor within the production of architecture, and this being this, I know Simon Henley and Henley Hale-Brown work, Maze work, and there's a whole host of projects work. Hannah wrote a lovely review of your exhibition in Apollo, which you sent link to me for, and it is really nice. And there is this moment, I think, that's occurring where there's a kind of desire to, I suppose, contest the privileged position. It's a sort of nonsense privileged position of the author, the architectural author. But I was thinking about this issue of authorship as you were talking, this not only in relation to your collaborative work, say, for example, with Sophia, but also in relation to the idea of, I suppose, again, going back to your practice, your process, like how you go about editing these things, and to what extent does authenticity feed into the, you know, the desire for quote unquote authenticity feed into what you do? And it's a complicated concept, authenticity. I haven't really got my head around it, but I was wondering if this was part of your trying to find the voice of the building through the people that use it is an act of sort of discerning authentic voice.
Yeah, I suppose there's a temptation, you know, with my work when it's at its best and it's got this sort of controlled mess and scruffy people, or not so scruffy people, in it. And I haven't exerted any sort of control over what people are doing in the space. Like, for instance, at May's Morden Centre that just won the Sterling Prize, when we photographed that, I just walked in and observed what was happening. At no point did I say to anybody, can you go and sit there, or can you do this, or can you do that? We just observed it. So there was very little coercion on my point. I suppose there's a temptation to think of it as being more authentic than, say, emptying it and then restyling the whole space. I would temper that temptation a little bit. I think authenticity in any photography or film, documentary, fiction or non-fiction film, it is complicated, because ultimately, even if I don't touch a room, I'm still pointing the camera at something and not pointing it at the other thing. So I always sort of, I do temper the idea that there's an authenticity. I suppose there is a degree, I mean, authenticity is a sliding scale. So I suppose it is slightly more authentic because I'm not styling anything, and I hardly ever style anything ever, like in my work. I can't think of an instance where I have for ages. So it does make it slightly more authentic. But I wouldn't want to get too wrapped up in it, to be honest. Also, it ends up being a noose that you hang yourself with if you declare your work to be absolute truth and authentic. This is the authentic life of this building, you know, and then someone goes there a week later and says, well, that thing that you said was authentic wasn't there when I was there, then, you know, your whole, everything's blown up. So
the whole world falls apart.
Yeah,
but it's an interesting and quite complicated thing. I mean, I was, because of the rise of these social media platforms in which people post photographs, and inauthenticity is the name of the game on that. I mean, you're immediately invited to run it through a filter, straighten the lines, heighten the contrast, sharpen it up, put a little vignette. You know, it's all of these rather pastiche things. And I do remember commenting on one of my ex-students who had gone all the way to Philadelphia to photograph Louis Kahn on his phone, and then running the Louis Kahn through a filter. And I thought, how dare you? Like, who the hell are you? I think this issue around authenticity and particularly the trustworthiness of images, it's all this post-truth society stuff, isn't it? I don't know, maybe you disagree, but the photographer, the formal official photographer, has an actual kind of ethical responsibility to try and tell some sort of truth, whether it's of the building as just an empty piece of space and stuff, or as a, you know, do you not agree? I don't know
if I agree totally. I mean, I, it's not black and white. I do agree to an extent, but my job isn't, okay, let me try and phrase this properly. Look, my job isn't to tell you exactly what color the brick was, or exactly what shade of brown or amber the timber cladding was. My job is to make you feel like, give you a little feeling of what it might be like to be there. So the minute I choose to do that rather than, you know, this very exacting, otherwise I'd be a forensic photographer, wouldn't I? Like, you know, I spoke about the photography talks we ran earlier, and I remember we had a forensic crime scene photographer come and talk to us 1 month, and his job was to eliminate any doubt that the thing that he was photographing is exactly how he would do it. So it is exactly what had happened. So if he was photographing a bloody knife on the kitchen floor, he would have to light it. He would have a flash with him so he could light it, so that the colors on the floor and the dimensions, everything was perfectly lined up. Everything was exactly as you would see it if you walked into the room. And that's a scientific pursuit of photography and necessary for the purposes of his images. My images aren't forensic. They're not a scientific documentation of the space. They're intended to give you a little feeling of what it might be like to be there. So for instance, the Peter Zumter house in Devon that he did for Living Architecture, when I turned up there, it was misty and windy and cold and dark when I first turned up to photograph it, because I went round to do a little recce the night before. In the images, I turned up the blue in the image because I wanted you to feel colder when you were looking at it, because it was fucking cold when I was there. And I wanted you to feel cold when you were there. And equally, when I went in for the internal shots in the evening, I made them a little bit warmer. I made them a little bit more orange because I wanted you to feel the relief of moving into a warm space after having been in the cold space. So I had played with the colors a little bit, not a huge amount, but a little bit, just to infer a little bit of, just to guide you a little bit and just to lead you a little bit. In the same way that Todd Hedo does with he's an incredible photographer. He does a similar thing, and he's more interested in giving you a feeling rather than than some kind of forensic documentation. Again, all of that has to exist within the realm of not completely falsifying the building. And I try not to alter, you know, a physical reality. You know, I'm not changing the colors of a wall or something, but I'm far more interested, again, in an ideal world, I'm far more interested in that emotional response you have from the images rather than some kind of, you know, technical response.
Do you find that the still image is a more effective, or at least less effective than the moving image, in terms of documenting these things? Where do you, where, I mean, I assume you like it, both sides of it, but where is your, I guess, just, what's your truest love?
Well, my truest love is architecture. And I really mean that. Like my, you know, my truest love is obviously Sophia and blah, blah, blah. But my truest love is
hierarchies. It's very important to get your hierarchies.
I'm just getting that in there now quickly. Architecture is my truest love. Like that, I mean, that's why I got into it. That's what I studied. I studied architectural technology, again, apologies to the ARB. And I worked in practice, and I worked in practice in America as well. And we go on holiday and we visit buildings because I want to look at architecture. The camera is just really a tool that I am using to continue to explore that. I'm incredibly lucky that I get paid to do that. And I can't separate it still from moving images. I never go on a film shoot and only shoot footage. I still take photographs still images whilst I'm filming as well. Because like I said earlier, it's instinctive and therefore quite impulsive a lot of the time. So it's not, and equally, I very rarely do a shoot where I only take photographs. I normally do a little bit of video here and there anyway. So I don't think there's any, for personally, I don't see any reason to try and separate the two. And I don't think to answer your question, I don't think any really work, either one works better than the other one. I mean, I think actually ultimately it comes down to who you're trying to translate the experience of being there to, you know, and what they want to see. Some people would rather see a film. Some people would rather look at some photographs. Some people would rather hear an interview with an architect talking about it. Some people would rather read a body of text. So I'd rather not rank them and just call them tools that we're using to communicate an experience. That's quite lofty. I realize that's quite lofty, but to answer your question, they're the same thing.
Perhaps you can talk a little bit about the other work of other people that have influenced and perhaps informed the way that you've approached The Architect Has Left the Building.
Yeah, there's been some huge influences on it. I mean, The Architect Has Left the Building is made up of a series of shots. The camera barely moves the whole time. In fact, I don't think the camera does move at all in the whole film, I think. And they're single shots of just watching people move in and out of space. And so 10 Meter Tower, which is a brilliant Swedish film by Max van Aertrik and Axel Danielsson, is a single shot of the top of the 10 meter tower in a swimming pool in a public bath, and you just watch members of the public go up to the top and build up the courage to jump off. And it has no jokes in it, but it will make you laugh out loud. It has no big romance story in it, but it will tug at your heartstrings. It has no peril in it, but there'll be bits where you'll be on the edge of your seat. And just to watch real people doing things that they would do anyway if they're just left alone in a space, it is really beautiful. And we wanted to get some of that kind of feeling out in our film, and in a similar way to kind of like, you know, London by Patrick Keeler is obviously a big influence, and Girl Chewing Gum, although it's a bit older, by John Smith as well. These kind of films that just observe stuff. I mean, you know, obviously London and Girl Chewing Gum have elements of fiction in, but yeah, those kind of observational documentaries, that's what really interests us. Also, Girl Chewing Gum and 10 Meter Tower are free to watch on YouTube. So 10 Meter Tower especially is just a work of complete genius, and I wish that we had done it before they did, because it's so good.
Good. Fantastic. Well, that's a great point to leave it on. Thank you ever so much. A picture, so it is said, is worth 1,000 words. What then a podcast about pictures? Mind-boggling. Thanks to Jim and Sophia for taking the time to speak. It was a huge pleasure. Go see their show at the Farrell Centre, of course. Jim is a big noise on Instagram too. Links to it and all are in the podcast description as ever, unless Spotify or iTunes screw it up again. Thanks for listening.